If consequences resulted from her behaving differently, then they, too, were functions of life's fundamental core. Tate's devotion eventually convinced her that human love is more than the bizarre mating competitions of the marsh creatures. But life also taught her that ancient genes for survival still persist in some undesirable forms among the twists and turns of man's genetic code. For Kaya, it was enough to be part of this natural sequence as sure as the tides. She was bonded to her planet and its life in a way few people are, rooted solid in this earth, born of this mother. At 64, Kaya's long black hair had turned as white as the sand. One evening, she did not return from a collecting trip. So Tate puttered around in the marsh, searching. As dusk eased in, he came around a bend and saw her drifting in her boat in a lagoon surrounded by sycamores touching the sky. She had slumped backward, her head lying against the old knapsack. He called her name softly, and when she didn't move, he shouted, then screamed. Pulling his boat next to hers, he stumbled awkwardly into the stern of her boat. Reaching out his long arms, he took her shoulders and gently shook her. Her head slumped farther to the side, her eyes not seeing. "Kaya! Kaya, no! No!" he screamed. Still young, so beautiful, her heart had quietly stopped. She had lived long enough to see the bald eagles make a comeback. For Kaya, that was long enough. Folding her in his arms, he rocked back and forth, weeping. He wrapped her in a blanket and towed her back to her lagoon in the old boat, through the maze of creeks and estuaries, passing the herons and deer for the last time. "And I'll hide the maid in a cypress tree when the footstep of death is near." He got special permission for her to be buried on her land under an oak overlooking the sea, and the whole town came out for the funeral. Kaya would not have believed the long lines of slow-moving mourners. Of course, Jody and his family came, and all of Tate's cousins. Some curiosity seekers attended, but most people came out of respect for how she had survived years alone in the wild. Some remembered the little girl, dressed in an oversized, shabby coat, boating to the wharf, walking barefoot to the grocery to buy grits. Others came to her graveside because her books had taught them how the marsh links the land to the sea, both needing the other. By now, Tate understood that her nickname was not cruel. Only few become legend. So he chose as the epitaph for her tombstone, "Catherine Danielle Clark, Kaya, the Marsh Girl, 1945 to 2009. The evening of her funeral, when everyone was finally gone, Tate stepped into her homemade lab. Her carefully labeled samples, more than 50 years worth, was the longest-running, most complete collection of its kind. She had requested that it be donated to Archibald Lab, and someday he would do so. But parting with it now was unthinkable. Walking into the shack, as she always called it, Tate felt the walls exhaling her breath, the floors whispering her steps so clear he called out her name. Then he stood against the wall, weeping. He lifted the old knapsack and held it to his chest. The officials at the courthouse had asked Tate to look for her will and birth certificate. In the old back bedroom, which had once been her parents', he rummaged through the closet and found boxes of her life stuffed in the bottom, almost hidden under some blankets. He pulled them onto the floor and sat beside them. Ever so carefully, he opened the old cigar box. The one where all the collecting began. The box still smelled of sweet tobacco and little girl. Among a few birds' feathers, insects' wings, and seeds was the small jar with the ashes from her ma's letter, and a bottle of Revlon fingernail polish, barely pink, the bits and bones of a life, the stones of her stream. Tucked in the bottom was the deed for the property, which Kaya had put in a conservation easement, protecting it from development. At least this fragment of the marsh would always be wild. But there was no will or personal papers, which did not surprise him. She would not have thought of such things. Tate planned to live out his days at her place, knowing she had wanted that and that Jody would not object. Late in the day, the sun dipping behind the lagoon, he stirred corn mush for the gulls and mindlessly glanced at the kitchen floor. He cocked his head as he noticed for the first time that the linoleum had not been installed under the wood pile or the old stove. Kaya had kept firewood stacked high, even in summer, but now it was low, and he saw the edge of a cutout in the floorboard. He moved the remaining logs aside and saw a trap door in the plywood. Kneeling down, he slowly opened it to find an enclosed compartment between the joists, which held, among other things, an old cardboard box covered in dust. He pulled it out and found inside scores of manila envelopes and a smaller box. All the envelopes were marked with the initials AH. And from them, he pulled out pages and pages of poetry by Amanda Hamilton, the local poet who had published simple verses in regional magazines. Tate had thought Hamilton's poems rather weak, but Kaya had always saved the published clippings. And here were envelopes full of them. Some of the written pages were completed poems, but most of them were unfinished, with lines crossed out and some words rewritten in the margin in the poet's handwriting. Kaya's handwriting. Amanda Hamilton was Kaya. Kaya was the poet. Tate's face grimaced in disbelief. Through the years, she must have put the poems in the rusty mailbox, submitting them to local publications, safe behind a nom de plume. Perhaps a reaching out, a way to express her feelings to someone other than gulls, somewhere for her words to go. He glanced through some of the poems, most about nature or love. One was folded neatly in its own envelope. He pulled it out and read, "The Firefly. Luring him was as easy as flashing valentines. But like a lady firefly, they hid a secret call to die. A final touch, unfinished. The last step, a trap. Down, down he falls, his eyes still holding mine, until they see another world. I saw them change. First a question, then an answer, finally an end. And love itself passing to whatever it was before it began. A.H." Still kneeling on the floor, he read it again. He held the paper next to his heart, throbbing inside his chest. He looked out the window, making certain no one was coming down the lane. Not that they would. Why would they? But to be sure. Then he opened the small box, knowing what he would find. There, laid out carefully on cotton, was the shell necklace Chase had worn until the night he died. Tate sat at the kitchen table for a long while, taking it in, imagining her riding on night buses, catching a riptide, planning around the moon, softly calling to Chase in the darkness, pushing him backward, then squatting in mud at the bottom, lifting his head, heavy with death, to retrieve the necklace. Covering her footprints, leaving no trace. Breaking kindling into bits, Tate built a fire in the old wood stove, and envelope by envelope, burned the poems. Maybe he didn't need to burn them all. Maybe he should have destroyed just the one. But he wasn't thinking clearly. The old yellowed papers made a great whoosh a foot high, then smoldered. He took the shell off the rawhide, dropped the rawhide in the fire, and put the boards back in the floor. Then, in near dusk, he walked to the beach and stood on a sharp bed of white and cracked mollusks and crab pieces. For a second, he stared at Chase's shell in his open palm, and then dropped it on the sand. Looking the same as all the others, it vanished. The tide was coming in, and a wave flowed over his feet, taking with it hundreds of seashells back into the sea. Kaya had been of this land and of this water. Now they would take her back, keep her secrets deep. And then the gulls came. Seeing him there, they spiraled above his head, calling, calling. As night fell, Tate walked back toward the shack. But when he reached the lagoon, he stopped under the deep canopy and watched hundreds of fireflies beckoning far into the dark reaches of the marsh, way out yonder where the crawdads sing. This is Cassandra Campbell. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens. This program was directed by Kim Smith, executive producer Linda Korn. Text copyright 2018 by Delia Owens. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.